Funding for Think is provided by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the value of feedback in our lives, and why is it so often hard to hear anything other than approval and praise? Most of us are aware that we're not perfect, and often we have a genuine desire to improve our appearance, our relationships, or our skills. And intellectually, we realize that constructive criticism can be a valuable tool for development. But as my guest today will tell us, while our society has paid a lot of attention to helping people give effective feedback, we've neglected to learn much about how to accept it gracefully and constructively. Sheila Heen is a lecturer on law at Harvard and co-founder of Triad Consulting. Her new book, written with co-author Douglas Stone, is called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well, Even When It Is Off-Base, Unfair, Poorly Delivered, and Frankly, You're Not in the Mood. Sheila, welcome to Think.
Well, thank you very much.
So for purposes of this discussion, what counts as feedback?
Well, one of the worries we have about the book is that people will assume it's only about performance evaluations or formal processes like 360-degree feedback, when really it's about learning from life and learning about yourself from life, which is a whole different ballgame than learning about anything else.
You had done some earlier work helping people navigate difficult conversations, and over people told you that feedback was often challenging. How did you begin to realize that the crux of the problem rested more with the receiver of the feedback than the giver?
Well, that was one of the things that was really interesting. As we worked across industries, across geographies, on six different continents, the first thing we always did was we asked groups, talk to us about your most challenging conversations. And it didn't matter where we were or who we were talking to or why they brought us in. Feedback was always on that list. And it would always start with giving honest feedback. But pretty quickly it would be followed by coping with receiving feedback that is unfair or off base. And in each case, what was common between the two was that at the end of the day, the feedback wasn't getting through, whether you were giving or receiving. And the receiver is really the key player in that, so that we teach people how to give feedback more skillfully, and that makes some difference. But if the receiver isn't ready and able to take in the feedback, you know, they're in charge of what they make of it and whether and how they choose to change. So we decided that the real leverage here was actually focusing on receiving.
It turns out that hearing feedback tends to set us off in three fairly predictable ways. Can you tell us what those are?
Yeah, so as we looked at what was getting in the way, what tended to block learning, there were three kinds of triggers that come up pretty instantaneously for most of us when we receive feedback. And we call them the challenge to see, the challenge of we, and the challenge of me. So truth triggers are all about the feedback itself, like that's not true, that's not fair, that's terrible advice. And we reject it because we think that it's simply wrong. We triggers or relationship triggers are all about the relationship itself, and often we have a reaction to who is giving us the feedback, like, excuse me, I was unaware I cared about your opinion,
right.
Or you have no credibility, or I feel so underappreciated by you that this petty criticism is completely out of proportion. And so we'll reject the feedback because of who gave it to us rather than what the feedback itself is. And then the final me piece of it, the challenge of being me, has to do with the way that each of us is wired. And if you look at some of the neuroscience, what you pretty quickly see is that individuals vary in their sensitivity to feedback, meaning how far they swing emotionally in the wake of positive or negative feedback, and how long it takes you to recover. And that variation between individuals can be up to 3,000%.
Wow.
Yeah.
So let's talk about those truth triggers. First of all, how can we tackle our own blind spots, you know, and not throw everything out as incorrect when, by definition, we don't realize we have blind spots?
Yeah, this is this is a fascinating phenomenon, which is if you think about the people you're close to in your family or your colleagues, you could probably name pretty quickly what their blind spots are, what they
right.
don't realize they do that upsets or irritates others or where they get in their own way. But by definition, we're just kind of at a loss. Like, well, I don't have blind spots, obviously, because I would know if I did. But that's the nature of blind spots. And there is actually information about you that other people have that you don't. So, you know, Who can see your face? Everybody else. Who can't see your face? You. You're the only person in the meeting that you can't observe. And so things like facial expression, tone of voice, verbal habits that you have, and even patterns of behavior, right? You have the same. You pick the same kind of person to date. It goes through a frenetic, romantic, excited phase. It settles down, and then 6 months later, you break up out of the blue. All of your friends recognize that you do this. You see no relationship in the last six, no pattern in the last six relationships, right?
So we
you actually need other people to help you see yourself.
So if our truth trigger is affected, you say it helps to make sure that we understand how this kind of feedback is intended and what it's suggesting?
Yeah, there. When we say the challenge to see, we mean two things. One is the one that we just talked about, which is it's really hard to see yourself, and particularly feedback that's in a blind spot. The second kind of challenge to see is the challenge to see what the feedback giver actually means by the feedback. Because feedback often comes in very vague labels, like, you know, you need to be more proactive. You need to work on your people skills. Who the heck knows what that means? And so we feel like we have to instantly decide whether to take the feedback or reject it because it's so upsetting. So we assume we know what it means based on what we think it means. And we don't have the follow-up conversation to say, okay, what in the world do you mean by more proactive? Where is that feedback coming from? What did you observe me doing or probably not doing that you expected me to do? And forward-looking, where is the feedback going? What is it that you're suggesting I do differently? If I can understand what's under the vague label, I actually understand better what the giver is trying to suggest, and givers are just poor at giving all the time. So you can't wait around for a good giver. Your life is populated by everybody else.
Sometimes, though, it does seem that the passage of time helps, right? You get a criticism and you take it home and it hurts your feelings and you think about it. And then the next day you go, well, maybe that part is true.
Yeah, that is so accurate. And I think that's part of the wiring challenge, which is when we're in the depths of upset, one of the things that happens is that the feedback kind of overflows its boundaries and becomes distorted. It becomes larger than life. And so you go from, you know, I sang that song off key to, you know, I can't sing at all to, well, this is just another example of I can't do anything right. And probably people have been secretly thinking about this about me for ages, right? And it'll never get better. So one thing becomes everything and now becomes forever. We also fall into something that we call the Google bias, which is when you're upset, it's as if you then type into Google everything that's wrong with me. Or all the mistakes I've ever made, and you get like 1.2 million hits, right? And there are these sponsored ads from your father or your ex, and, you know, with examples. And so this one piece of feedback actually can bring to mind all of the mistakes that you've made. And that's not a balanced picture of who you are, in part because of the search term. You didn't type in the things that I'm handling well or the things that I've learned from experience, which would actually give you a whole different set of hits. And so part of the challenge is in that time period recognizing your own pattern and realizing, okay, by tomorrow, that's when I need to, you know, if that's your recovery period, this will look different. It's not as bad as I think. So one of the things the book does is give people a bunch of lifelines for when you're in that period.
How to sort of work your way out of it or at least survive it without feeling just terrible the whole time.
Feeling terrible the whole time, and that distortion both distorts the feedback and it distorts your sense of self. So what are some techniques that will help you see the feedback at actual size?
All right, so relationship triggers are very interesting. I've considered this, that if my boss has an idea for how I can do my job better, it's pretty easy to accept typically, but if my husband has a suggestion, I bristle at that, even if the advice is exactly the same.
Yes, that is such a great observation. Yeah, who gives us the advice colors everything, and it is one of the reasons why a very close friend can tell you things that somebody else couldn't. But it also goes the other way. Sometimes those closest to us, we bristle at what they have to say because of other issues in the relationship. You know, like you're thinking, well, you don't even understand what I do or appreciate what I do, or, you know, to your husband, or the last time I tried your advice, it was a disaster, so I'm not listening to you anymore. Where a stranger or your boss, who you may know less well and who knows you less well, but somehow you're more open to hearing it because you're not, it's not tainted by whatever is going on in the relationship.
But again, in the example I cited, the information is the same. So what do we do to get past the fact that the relationship kind of skewed our perception, but it might in fact be something we can really use?
Yeah, so we describe ways that you can separate the who from the what of the feedback. And so this might have been exactly the wrong person to give it to you. They might have no credibility. You may not trust their motives. So put that on one side of the page. On the other side of the page, separate from, okay, well, what is it that they said or suggested? Do I think that that would actually help? Is it worth trying it in maybe a small experiment just to see whether it would help?
Yeah, you mentioned this idea that we can experiment with things. It doesn't mean we have committed to doing them for a lifetime. It means if for no other reason than to prove it's not going to work, it often doesn't hurt to try these little experiments.
Yeah, often people are arguing with us that you have to make some big radical change. And first of all, who has time to focus on too many big radical changes in your life? It's exhausting. And so in trying to lower the stakes, thinking, look, I don't know if this would work or not, but I don't have to know to try it. So maybe I'll try it in some small way, and I'll just see what happens. And then it's also a way to take back control of, okay, I get to decide whether I'm going to take this advice, and I'm going to try it in small doses that feel comfortable to me. And the notion that it won't work and then I'll be right, you know, helps you be lured into trying it, right, even if it's for the wrong reasons. And you might be surprised.
So in some cases, feedback within a relationship, whether it's with a partner or a friend or a colleague, feels like it's all about blaming you for a problem, when in fact, it might be a factor of the dynamic of the relationship itself.
Yeah, it's very well put. So what's interesting is that we really think about two kinds of coaching. One is like your husband coaching you on how to, you know, fix your email or do something that's a topic, learn how to play tennis. The other kind of coaching is what we call relationship coaching, which is that there are complaints in the relationship. They're not motivated by a desire to help you get better at something. They actually come from the other person in the relationship being unhappy about something, right? You need to deal with your snoring because it's keeping me awake. Or, you know, if you can't pick up after yourself, this is going to drive me crazy because you're such a slob. It's not motivated by me hoping you're a better person as much as it is me being frustrated by you leaving everything out on the counter every single time you walk through the kitchen. And often that is produced by differences inside the relationship. You know, on their own, those traits aren't bad, but the combination creates friction. One of the silly examples we give is if I speak English and you speak Swedish, that's fine, but together we're going to have trouble.
Right. So what do we do about that?
Well, one of the things to get out of is the struggle, which implicitly comes down to, like, who is broken or who needs to change? Mm-hmm. Whose fault is it that we're having this problem? To then look at what is the intersection between us that's getting in our own way? So if one of the things that is causing trouble between us in a working relationship is that I really like to get things done early so I'm not stressed, and you tend to line things up so that they're done just in time. There's nothing wrong with either of those strategies, but they're going to be extremely stressful for me, and ultimately I'm going to make them stressful for you as a result. And so stepping back to say, okay, is there something about our styles that's clashing? So it's not that one of us is a terrible person. Then we might be able to create strategies to work around the difference.
Sheila Heen,
blaming each other.
Sheila Heen is my guest. She teaches law at Harvard, and she's a co-founder of Triad Consulting and co-author of the new book, Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sheila Heen. She is a lecturer on law at Harvard and co-founder of Triad Consulting, along with her co-author, Douglas Stone, of the new book, Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org, by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Sheila, what do we do about feedback that may be kindly intended, but refers to something that we have no desire to change and that someone else might perceive to be a flaw in us, but we don't see? For example, someone who says, you'd really look much prettier as a blonde. If you don't want to dye your hair and you think you look fine, what do you do with that? And how do you handle the person who gave you the feedback?
Oh, that is such a great example. Who do we imagine is saying this to you, by the way?
Oh, goodness. Let me think. Let's say your mother-in-law. My mother-in-law has never said this to me, but I'm going to throw that out there. I have a lovely mother-in-law.
Yeah, mother-in-laws do tend to have agendas for us of all sorts. So I'm really glad that you brought this up, because one of the things that we want to be really clear about is that receiving feedback well doesn't mean that you have to take the feedback or take the advice. It means that you get better at sorting it and being thoughtful about it and fully understanding what they mean and what's motivating it, and then decide for yourself whether it's right for you or not. And it could be that the feedback is actually good, but not right now. Mm-hmm. Like, you have other things and other priorities that you need to focus on. So now is not the time that you're going to lose that weight, you know, or dye your hair blonde. Like, when the quintuplets go to college, then you'll focus on it, right?
Right.
And one of the things that we included in the book is a chapter on boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So that if you aren't going to take the feedback, that's one kind of boundary, just to circle back to the person and say, you know, hey, thanks for your input. I'll keep that in mind, you know, the next time I go to the hairstylist, although I'm not sure I'm going to follow it up real soon.
Mm-hmm.
But coming back to either let them know if you are or aren't going to take the advice and why, sometimes actually is quite important, particularly if it's coming from a colleague.
Because I suppose—go ahead.
Well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I suppose it's no better. We want to be able to receive feedback well, but what you're not suggesting here is that we listen to every criticism people have for us and try to please everybody, because that's impossible.
I think it's impossible, and it's a really nice segue to what I was going to add, actually, which is, I do also think there are times where it's not just that I'm not going to take your feedback, but I actually need you to keep your thoughts and judgments and comments to yourself. That we need a boundary that says the relentlessness of the criticism or of the coaching, whether it's well-intended or not, is really having a bad impact. And so for now, let's imagine, you know, as I'm learning how to be a new parent, I need to find my own feet, and so your constant suggestions for what I should be doing differently actually aren't helping. Why don't we check back in 6 months, and maybe I'll be more receptive. Or, you know, if you can't keep your comments to yourself, it's hard for me to have you here, because I'm finding who I am and how I want to do this. And I think having those boundaries is an incredibly healthy way to be a feedback receiver, because you know what you can take and what's helpful to you and what actually undermines your sense of self-worth.
Okay, let's talk about what may be the biggest one here, which is identity triggers. Talk about what we can do with them and recognize them so that they don't get the best of us.
Yeah, for this we really are drawing on some fantastic work by a woman named Carol Dweck out at Stanford. And Carol took a look at kids, and she would set them up with puzzles, and the puzzles would be increasingly difficult. And what she wanted to see was how kids reacted to failure, how it affected their identity or sense of self. And what she found is that some kids sort of followed the predictable path, which is that as the puzzles got harder, they started to get frustrated, they started to get a little embarrassed, and then they gave up. But then there were some kids who actually, as the puzzles got harder, got more excited, and who said things like, wow, I was hoping this would be challenging.
Hmm.
And she thought, what is wrong with these kids, right? Do they not understand that they're failing? And what she came to see was that they actually had a mindset, she calls it, that assumed that challenge is the only way to learn, whereas the kids who got frustrated and embarrassed and gave up earlier had what she calls a fixed mindset, which is you're either smart or you're not. And the puzzles, as they got harder, were starting to whisper, you're not smart enough for this, right? So as they started to feel like, oh, my gosh, maybe I'm not smart, they didn't want to do the task anymore, so they tend to shrink away from challenge. So we took Carol's work into our work to say, this is a way that you can hold your identity and move from a fixed identity, which is you are who you are, your traits are fixed, and that means every piece of feedback is a verdict on who you are, which is really threatening, and instead to cultivate a growth identity, which assumes how I am now is just how I am now. Hard work and challenge actually help me get better. And if that's the case, if I can hold on to that, then feedback is actually important input, so I know where I stand and what I should work on next. So I see it actually as helpful rather than threatening.
So that makes, Sheila, beautiful intellectual sense, I think probably to most people who are listening. But we still come upon the fact, and you deal with this in the book, that we all kind of need to be loved and appreciated for who we are right at this moment.
Yeah, and I think that that's a fundamental tension that is built into feedback. As you said in your terrific introduction, we actually are wired to learn and grow and enjoy mastery. That's a key piece in the happiness research for what gives us satisfaction in life, and it's why we pick up new hobbies in retirement. Like, we should be done learning, but getting better at something is really satisfying. It's also why we're addicted to all those phone games, right? iPhone games. But then that sits alongside a pretty deep desire to be loved and accepted and respected the way we are now, and the very fact of feedback suggests that how we are now isn't quite A-okay. So I do think that there aren't simple answers for that, and I think that it is something that you have to work on and work at. Two things that can help quickly. One is what we call sort for coaching. In other words, even when it is an evaluation, a judgment about you, right? You get your performance appraisal. You get back a test score or a college verdict for either yourself or your kids. Asking yourself, okay, this is evaluation, but what if it were coaching? What if it was trying to tell me something that I could learn from this? What is it that it's trying to tell me? Actually changes the question and changes where your attention sits. And the second is to give yourself what we call a second score. The first score is whatever the evaluation is. You flunked the test or you didn't. The second is a score that you give yourself for how you handle it. You may need to go off and lick your wounds for a little while, but do you pick it up and decide to make meaning out of it in a way that's useful to you? What does it spur you to do next? So that when you look back, you think, you know what, it was really hard at the time, but I learned some important things and it actually motivated me. And I can be proud that I handled it well.
So sometimes cooler heads do prevail in the end, and we're able to get there and learn something from feedback. But what do we do to sort of tamp down that instant instinct toward defensiveness so that we might, we'll just start there. What do we do about defensiveness?
I mean, I think that admitting that you feel defensive actually helps. So I think trying to pretend you don't is actually a recipe for both looking obviously defensive to the other person because they're not particularly fooled, but also it doesn't give that feeling of being under attack and maybe unfairly any release valve. So I think actually sometimes you can just say, okay, I'm feeling a little bit defensive because this is really hard for me to hear. I don't know yet whether it's right, although I fear some of it might be right. But I just need to better understand what you're saying. So that just by naming it, in some ways, it puts it on the table where you don't have to fight it. And then you can turn to, just help me understand, but realize I'm struggling to understand what you're saying or what the implications are.
It's funny that we react so strongly to defensiveness, like suddenly the conversation becomes about that rather than about the original subject.
Yes, yes, it does. And in some ways we call this switch tracking. Which is somebody comes in and has a piece of feedback for you. There's a great scene that we include in the book from Lucky Louie, Louis C.K.'s HBO sitcom. And he gives his wife, Kim, he comes home and gives her flowers. He gives her red roses. And she pauses for a minute and says, look, if we're going to be married for 30 years, you just need to know that I don't like red roses. And he immediately responds with, well, okay, so can I just give you some advice on how you told me that, I think you should have thanked me for the flowers first and then said the thing about the roses.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, right, but I've told you I don't like roses before, remember? And he says, right, but it would just be polite for you to thank me. So they get in a fight. And what they're not realizing in the fight, as it escalates, is that they're actually talking about two different topics. Kim is talking about the fact that Louis doesn't listen to her because she's told him a million times and he still comes home and gives her red roses. And he's talking about feeling underappreciated. And in his defensiveness, that is the topic, which is that you don't appreciate that I actually went out of my way even if I got it wrong. And each hears the other through the lens of their own topic. So sometimes I think the only thing you can do is realize, we call them switch tracks because they start out on one topic and then the two rails diverge so that there are two topics and each is getting further and further apart. The only thing to do is actually recognize, actually, we have two topics here. One is the reasons that I feel defensive or frustrated because, you know, after all I did for you, this is what I'm getting. And the other is your original feedback to me, which I don't want to lose sight of. We need to talk about both of them so that you're just naming the two and then talking about both.
When is it appropriate to explain why something we've done is not as good as it should have been, and when does that start to sound like an excuse and make us look defensive?
Well, it's a great question. I'm pausing because I actually think in most cases you look more competent when you can say, look, I think that this was good. It was fine. I think there are a couple ways I could have handled it better, right? So that you're pointing out, I'm actually learning from this. If what you did was really a disaster, it might even be more important because then the other person doesn't think that you think it's good.
Yeah.
You know, but saying, look, I think I screwed this up. I really left it to the last minute and I'm not happy with what I turned in actually says the other person, I have the same standards as you, so you can trust me. At the same time, there are people who will nitpick about everything so that they're getting positive evaluation from other people. Other people are telling them that it's fantastic, but because they are uncomfortable with positive feedback, which is pretty common actually, what they have to say is, oh, it really wasn't as good as I wanted. I really thought that I missed that one note. And you know, that I think is actually, you just need to learn to hear the positive feedback and not make excuses about it.
That's interesting. And do you think that that's a way of defending themselves against what could be negative feedback down the line? Or do you think that's simply a disbelief that the positive feedback is, in fact, genuine?
I think it could be either, depending on who they are. I think overachievers and perfectionists in particular, part of what drives us, you, me, all those overachievers out there, is we want to do it exactly right so that we don't get any negative feedback, but you just can't outrun feedback, right? You
right.
can't do everything perfectly, which becomes clearer and clearer as you get older, unfortunately. But it's actually what we're thinking about. When other people are saying that was terrific, what we're preoccupied with is, oh, but I know that I missed that one note.
And what are they not saying?
It out.
Yeah.
Right. Or what are they not saying? Because also, we're more critical of ourselves than they are of anybody, right? Or of us. And so we actually think this was a B performance. They think it was an A performance. And, you know, based on what they expected and what they needed, let it be an A. You know you could have been better, but they don't know the difference. If it met their purposes, that's great.
It is interesting, this idea, because it's counterintuitive that when someone has given you negative feedback, you actually look better if you say, you know, I get it. You're right about that. And you come across as more confident than someone who maybe tries to give excuses for why things didn't go right.
I think that's right, and it is counterintuitive. And in fact, your suggestion earlier that bringing it up yourself, if it's relevant, actually makes you look more competent. Like when it's relevant, meaning not when everyone's telling you something was great, but when there's a meeting to talk about how it went.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, you know, I was really pleased with these things. I do think around the edges there are some things I want to handle differently next time. I'm curious about people's thoughts about it. so that you're actually inviting coaching from other people and their constructive comments. And by the way, the research shows that people who seek out what is called in the literature negative feedback, and what they mean is you're not just fishing for compliments, mm-hmm. but you're looking for coaching, tend to adapt more quickly to new roles, tend to have higher satisfaction at work, and get higher performance reviews. And I think it's because you demonstrate, like, I'm confident enough and committed enough to excellence and continuous learning that I'm actually seeking out, is there, what's one thing I could have done differently that would have made this even better?
And the one thing is important, it turns out, because if you go in asking for sort of a global assessment to somebody who's not prepared to give one, the feedback you receive may be too amorphous to really do much with.
Yeah. One of the worst questions you can ask, interestingly, is, hey, do you have any feedback for me? It's just way too broad. It's not clear how honest you want anybody to be. And it's almost as if you want them to deliver a PhD on me.
Right.
And so a better question, which is both lower stakes and clear that you actually want them to be honest, is to say, hey, what's one thing that you see me doing or failing to do where I'm getting in my own way? Or what's one thing I could change that would matter to you or be helpful to you? And one thing is easy, right? They can just name the first thing off the top of their head or the last annoying thing that you did today. And it also is less threatening because it's one very specific thing that's more likely to be useful.
Sheila Heen is my guest. She's a lecturer on law at Harvard University School of Law and co-founder of Triad Consulting. Her new book, written with co-author Douglas Stone, is called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. Send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think is provided by SMU Summer Youth, with more than 30 new programs for students entering kindergarten through 12th grade at SMU in Plano from June through August. Registration opens March 5th at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Sheila Heen is my guest. She teaches law at Harvard and is co-author, along with Douglas Stone, of the new book Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Jessica, who writes, I'm a creative writing professor, and I emphasize to my writing workshop students to always give positive before negative feedback. Is there any research to support that hearing positive feedback before negative feedback enhances the listener's ability to hear and internalize both types?
Well, it's a great question. I don't know of research that demonstrates it, but I think particularly in a creative writing program, one of the things that she is really insightful about is that when we have poured our heart and soul into a piece, part of what we need is appreciation. And we actually talk about three different kinds of feedback. Appreciation says, I see you, I get you, I value you. What you're doing matters. And it keeps people motivated. So when you are particularly showing your work to other people, you need that in order to stay motivated. And I do think that in that context in particular, it will help you hear then the second kind of feedback that follows, which is coaching. Coaching is aimed at helping you get better at something. The last kind of feedback, by the way, is evaluation, which rates or ranks you. It tells you where you stand. Obviously, those are performance evaluations at work, but also in relationships. All those conversations about, you know, I just need to know where we stand in this relationship, where this is going, is an attempt to say, I just need to understand what to expect. And that's true whether it's in the workplace or your personal life. And the problem is that evaluation is the loudest emotionally. So sometimes it can drown out the other two.
So in other words, we look at our ranking and don't think, okay, there's still room for growth here. We forget that part.
We forget that part, or we're so either delighted, like our ranking is better than we thought, or devastated because it's not as good as we thought, that we're busy coping with our emotional reaction, mm-hmm. distracted by that, so that we actually aren't listening to the coaching. They actually did MRIs of people taking tests and then getting feedback on which things they got wrong and what the right answers were. And what they found, this is part of work related to Carol Dweck's work, that people with a growth mindset listened really carefully to the answers they got wrong and what the right answers were. And people with a fixed mindset listened to know that they got it wrong, but then they stopped listening to what the right answers were. They're too preoccupied with how upset they feel about getting it wrong to actually hear the coaching. And so, of course, when both groups are retested, the growth mindset folks do better in retesting. So I think that the writing instructor is doing a great job of setting her students up to hear the coaching by putting the appreciation first. I think in some other contexts, people will just either dismiss the appreciation, like that's just fluff warm-up for what, you know, the other shoe is going to drop here.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll feel like they're suspicious or they're getting set up. You want to be careful about that. It has to be genuine. Or for some people who are kind of on the insensitive end of feedback, they'll only hear the good stuff, and then they'll ignore. They'll ignore the coaching, and what they'll remember is the good stuff. So it could be that with some students, she would notice that they didn't really seem to hear any of the coaching.
So if we work in any kind of hierarchical structure, Sheila, we tend to look up the chain for feedback when we're seeking it out for ourselves. But I wonder how important it is to also check in with our peers and even subordinates to find out how we're doing.
Yeah, that's such a great question. One of the surprising things to me is that one of the most valuable players in the feedback game for you are the people and maybe their peers or maybe their team members below you that you have the hardest time working with.
Hmm.
And so often, you know, when we're asked to collect feedback from colleagues, we'll go to the people that we like and we know like us.
Right.
But they don't see your edges, right? You work pretty easily with them. And if you actually want to get better, going to one of the people that you actually struggle to work well with to ask them, hey, look, what's one thing I'm doing that's getting in the way as we try to work together, that person does see your edges, partly because they're so good at provoking them, right? They drive you crazy. And so they actually can tell you something valuable, and simply asking the question can help improve the relationship.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Steve in Denton. Hello, Steve.
I love the show, by the way. I have a question for you. This is a great topic. I'm a managing director for a large company, and it's very related to something you just touched on, which is the idea of certainly everybody understands the idea of the boss giving feedback to the subordinates. But, as a person who knows and understands very well that the people who report to me are the ones that are going to be driving our collective success, it's extremely important for me to get good feedback from my subordinates. But oftentimes, you know, that is a bit of a challenge because people always feel a bit nervous about, giving feedback to the boss in terms of, you know, what the boss may or may not be doing right. So can you give suggestions on what is kind of the proper environments and the best ways or some methods for making sure that you do get that good collective feedback from the subordinates without it being kind of put through a filter of being, you know, afraid of what the boss is going to hear?
What an interesting question. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I love, by the way, that Steve is being so thoughtful and working hard at it, because I absolutely agree with him. The higher you rise in an organization, the less feedback you're going to get, because people don't want to jeopardize their relationship with you. And yet, the people below you are exactly the people who know all the things you do that make it harder for them to do their job. I sometimes have leaders say to me, well, I don't really know what I should improve on. And I'm like, okay, well, the people below you, actually, they know. They have a list. They keep it in their drawer of all the things you do that make it more difficult for them to perform. So I think that you do have to work harder at it. And a couple of things that can lower the stakes for them. One is when they have to write it down and send it into a formal process, it feels riskier. than if it's just you dropping by for an informal chat to say, you know, I didn't think that meeting went so well. So you're making it very about something specific rather than comment on my personality.
Hmm.
I wondered if you had suggestions for how I could have, we sort of got stuck, you know, and bogged down. And I wonder if you had any suggestions for me so that you are asking for targeted suggestions. And simply by doing this on a regular basis, you're actually demonstrating what you value and that you value learning. So not only will it help you, but you're also sort of inculcating and role modeling the way that you want them to hear your feedback. So I think it actually makes the whole process work better.
That's very interesting. So if you've made it clear that you're open to feedback and you see it as a tool for growth, then when you turn around and give feedback to someone that might be somewhat negative, the idea is that they will be more apt to see it as constructive criticism rather than simply a way to make you feel bad.
I think that that's exactly right. And also you've got shared experience with it. So you can say to them, look, I know that this is hard to hear. I think you're probably feeling the way that I felt 6 months ago when that customer said to me that we had really let them down.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't happy about it. I wasn't sure that they were right. It took me a long time to see what I was going to learn from it. And also, you don't have to be 100% right or 100% wrong, so that you're lowering the stakes to say, look, maybe this feedback is 90% wrong, but the 10% that might be right, I think is maybe exactly what you need to grow.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Ryan in Dallas. Hi, Ryan.
Hi. How's it going?
Great. Thank you.
I just had a question about, I have children, and I wondered how I can sort of help them develop that growth mindset that you guys are talking about.
Oh, Ryan, I love this question. I love this question for two reasons. One is, I actually have an answer for it, which is always helpful when you're a guest on a show. And two, I think it's one of the most important things that we can do for our kids, which is to help them interpret setback or criticism or failure or a bad grade or a bad call by the ump as an opportunity and not as something that they blame and shake their fist at. So Dweck has one answer, and I'll add one more. Dweck's experiments actually, she ran a second set where kids were given a puzzle that they could solve, and then they were asked if they wanted to do a second puzzle. And half the kids, when they solved the first puzzle, were told, wow, you're really smart. Do you want to do another puzzle?
Hmm.
The other set were told, wow, you worked really hard at that. Do you want to do another puzzle? And it, of course, when asked, it was the second set of kids who said yes. The first set, you're really smart, they don't want to risk not being smart if they can't do the next puzzle. Whereas, wow, you worked really hard at that. Praising the process or the effort involved and pointing out that nobody is good at the guitar for the first 6 months, but that's how you get better. And wow, you're working really hard at it. Or tell me about this painting. It's got a lot of color. I can see you put a lot of effort into it. Makes a huge difference. The second is that to be mindful, and Ryan can be mindful like Steve is, that your kids are watching how you respond to feedback, to the note from the neighbor about your dog, to disappointment at work. And they're watching how you react to the umpire after the bad call, so that if you want them to see it as a learning opportunity, you need to behave like it's a learning opportunity.
Does practice with accepting feedback in constructive ways and seeing it as coaching also help us to refine our ability to assess our own performance?
I think it does. So it helps in both directions. Understanding what's hard about receiving feedback and working to get better at it yourself, it helps you become a better giver because you can anticipate what's going on for your receiver as you're giving them feedback. But I think it also helps you see yourself more accurately. I think that that's right. And it's never, you know, it's never been more important. Some of the research around happy marriages identifies the willingness of spouses to receive coaching or be influenced by the other as one of the factors that makes the most difference in a happy marriage.
So you have to be open to change and to recognizing that there might be better ways to do things than you have seen in the past.
Yeah, and of course, you don't really hear the complaints from your spouse as quote-unquote feedback. You just hear it as them being annoying.
Uh-huh. Nagging, whatever, yeah.
Nagging, you know, why can't you accept me the way I am? But being willing to at least acknowledge the impact it has on them when you are this way, and to try to get a little bit better, sometimes the effort matters as much as the outcome.
How does it work? I know that universities are famous for sort of sending students forms when teachers are up for tenure, that sort of thing. Is that a good model to sort of give everybody involved with a particular individual the opportunity to leave feedback that may, in fact, be anonymous?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that the intention, both with anonymous student evaluations or 360 input, which is often anonymous, is to encourage people to be honest. And that is met with varying success. You know, it depends on how many students you had or how many direct reports you have, whether people trust that it really is anonymous. Mm-hmm. So it does help the university, let's say, or the organization have information so that they can use it to inform decision making. But the limitation is that there isn't an opportunity for a follow-up conversation. So you find out that, you know, four of your students really hated the class and thought you were pompous. I had a professor say that his favorite student comment, which has always stuck with him, was, "I couldn't decide whether Professor so-and-so was a nice guy pretending to be a jerk or a jerk pretending to be a nice guy." And he said, it was such a blow. Of course, I've always remembered it. He goes, "But I really want to know what they meant. What was it that I was doing?"
Hmm.
And, you know, there's no opportunity to actually understand the feedback better, which is what he needed probably to actually act on it.
Did your experience with feedback make it super easy to submit your manuscript to to an editor and have it sort of evaluated and changed and suggested?
Oh, that is such a great question. In fact, my co-author, we were corresponding today with our publisher, since today is our official release day, and our editor, who we've known for a long time, and my co-author said, "You know, it's occurring to me only today that when we were working so hard on the manuscript for the last 2 years full time, the only person I really wanted to like it was you, Rick, our editor." And now it's occurring to me that I really hope the other 6.5 billion people on the planet really like it too. So I think there's a pending article here about the experience of co-writing, because it's constant feedback to each other, constant reactions to the draft that we're passing back and forth, and then, of course, comments from the editor. And so I do think that as writers, we're really sensitive to what other people think of the ideas we put out and how we express them.
Well, keep in touch if you write that follow-up. We'd love to talk to you about that.
Thank you.
Sheila Heen is a lecturer on law at Harvard. Her new book, written with co-author Douglas Stone, is called Thanks for the Feedback, The Science and Art of Receiving Feedback Well. Sheila, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
You were terrific. That's just a little feedback for you.
Thank you. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.